Remember MySpace? It used to be the social media juggernaut, the place where teens especially made personalized web pages. Then Facebook took over, and more of teens' online social lives moved to phones. Now the conversations are spread across many social networks. For our monthly look at media for young people, NPR's Sammy Yenigun talked with a group of suburban teens to find out how they use all these different platforms.
18-year-old Jamal Royster's phone is packed with apps, all the usual suspects.
I got some Twitter, some Snapchat, some Vine, I got Instagram and Facebook.
This cozy living room in suburban Maryland has about a dozen teens sitting on couches in the carpeted floor. They've come to tell me how they talk, to friends of friends, to Facebook friends.
Long-lost friends, you usually hit them up on Facebook, like messages. I've gotten messages like that and like caught up with my friends, like I'm catching up with my friend Paul right now.
But 17-year-old Jelani Williamson says he doesn't use it much anymore.
I used to be on Facebook daily until my aunt friend requested me.
But there are a couple things Facebook's still good for. Practical things, like messaging, coordinating on school projects when you don't want to hand out your phone number, and inviting friends to parties. Well, parties at someone else's house, Williamson says.
Oftentimes, like, parties that are all over social media get, like, busted by the cops really easily.
Okay, so how do you invite friends over without inviting the 5-0? 18-year-old Darian Carr used to use the messaging app Kik when he had an iPod Touch. Kik's just like texting, but over the internet. No cell phone service required. But then Carr got an iPhone, and Kik sort of dropped off.
Not a lot of people had it, and it was just more practical to text people than to use Kik.
For quick, one-on-one conversations, texting rules. But for personal expression, teens like Royster take to Twitter.
People be in their feelings on Twitter. They vent.
It's a place for opinions, Williamson says.
Usually I tweet like what's on my mind, like, oh, like Beyonce looks amazing in this video.
But Twitter's focus is text. When these kids want a more visual way to share themselves, they do what Grace Pleahall does.
I'm a self-proclaimed Instagram addict. I Instagram everything. Like, it's kind of like my way of showing my life to the world, I guess. So, yeah, I use it a lot.
Pleahall's world, her friends, her surroundings, are sent through grainy filters to her 600-something Instagram followers. She says she takes a lot of selfies, pictures of herself, hanging out in New York, chilling in the subway, spending time with her siblings, etc. Jelani Williamson says it's how you let your friends know you're keeping it real.
Instagram is used to, like, verify your life because, like, at school and things like that, you can just say that you do things that you don't. And people do that a lot. But if you Instagram it, it's like, yes, I didn't make this up.
But not everyone feels comfortable posting pictures of themselves online. And for those camera-shy sharers, there's Tumblr, says Caroline Lamb.
It's showing your life without showing your face. So, like, Instagram, you show your life and yourself in your life. But on Tumblr, you, like, put quotes and pictures of other people doing funny stuff.
It's well understood in this group of kids that once a picture makes its way onto a site like Tumblr, it'll likely never fully disappear from the web. So what if you want to share a picture, but you don't want it to hang around? Royster says, Snapchat.
The reason for Snapchat, like, whoever thought of that, like, I'm worried about what they were thinking about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Pictures that just disappear after 10 seconds, like...
Yeah. Makes sense that selfies get a little racy when they only live for a little while. Snapchat, like Instagram, is for still photos, and one of the newer platforms, Vine, is for short films. Really short. 7 seconds. 17-year-old Jesse Annabonham says Vine videos tend to be well thought out short movies. His favorite this week?
The Waka Flocka Elmo Vine.
Drinking champagne, one deep in my Phantom Ghost.
That's a 7-second loop of Sesame Street's favorite red furball getting down to the sounds of Waka Flocka Flame. But this video wasn't just on Vine. When you upload, Vine lets you post to Facebook and Twitter at the same time. All of these networks are connected. In fact, Annabonham says he watches Vines without even having the Vine app.
For some reason, my phone won't let me download Vine. I don't know why, but if I see it on Twitter, I'll, like, favorite it and then show somebody because it's funny.
One person in this room, 15-year-old Carmen Hamlet, has been really quiet this whole time.
I don't have a phone.
So when Hamlet wants to hang in this vibrant cyber world of jokes, jams, and social scrapbooking, she has to borrow a phone. Or she could always go back to a computer. Sammy Yenigun, NPR News.
This month, we're taking a closer look at media for young people. And while toys may seem more and more high-tech, one of the hottest toys right now is low-tech, the building block. Last year, sales of building toys were up 20%, as NPR's Neda Ulaby reports.
If you want to hype the newest, trendiest toys, Toy Fair is the only game in town. It's the giant, glitzy showcase for the next big thing in toys. Once a year, New York's biggest convention center is crammed with robots that can draw, zombie Disney princesses, digitized doll outfits that glow with pink LED lights. Meanwhile, Youssef Asmani has set up a booth selling wooden blocks. Don't blocks get boring?
Not these. We've got everything from triangle blocks to regular blocks, flat blocks.
Asmani is among dozens of little guys selling blocks of various varieties. But Toy Fair's real estate is ruled by Lego, Hasbro, and Mattel, all showing off the slickest in construction sets for boys and girls.
See what happens when you build in style with the fab new world of
Mega Blocks Barbie!
You can build! Wow!
Yes, those blocks are pink. But when do blocks stop being blocks? These sets come with little figures, half-completed castles or forts, and inescapably, cross-promotional licensing.
Lego Harry Potter, years 5 through 7.
That's if you like your Legos with owl accessories, Harry Potter dolls, and pre-existing stories. Marketing and gimmicks have been around as long as block sets themselves, says curator Sarah Levitt. That is, since the mid-19th century.
A lot of these, even the old ones, have pretty extensive instruction booklets about what to build.
Maybe because a parent in the 1880s would wonder, why buy a block of wood for my kid to play with?
I can get one out back. Exactly.
But people were beginning to understand how block play develops kids' sense of spatial relations. Entire educational philosophies were built upon the block. Maria Montessori's, Friedrich Froebel's.
Frank Lloyd Wright himself is famous for having played with blocks, in his case, the Froebel blocks as a kid.
Frank's son, John Lloyd Wright, invented Lincoln Logs back in 1910.
Are you building a house? You say house?
House.
Kids still get lost in Lincoln Logs at the National Building Museum.
What are you going to build?
There's an exhibit there all about blocks. It's dominated by a futuristic block playground created by David Rockwell. He's a major name in the design world. Small children heave around blocks made out of foam as blue as the ocean. They stack and demolish blue tubes, balls, bricks, bars, and cubes.
What are you building?
Empire State Building.
It's a regular block party, says mom Rosalie Gonzalez.
He loves huge blocks, so this is amazing.
Older kids transfer their love of block play into Minecraft. That's a video game where you build block-based worlds of fields, woods, caves.
Let's go to a place where everything is made of blocks.
From fluffy sheep to the green block grass they eat. Minecraft has about 10 million players, all stacking and demolishing virtual blocks and teaching each other how to play on YouTube.
I've set up a map here with all these blocks laid out in one spot so we can go over them. And all these blocks are dirt.
What on earth would Maria Montessori even think about these computer-generated blocks and the complicated games kids play with them?
Montessori was quite a brilliant woman. I think she'd be very interested in what's going on today.
Karen Hewitt is a toy designer and historian. She doubts Montessori would find much use for Minecraft. Karen Hewitt gives us this definition of what makes a block.
That it's three-dimensional, that it's non-representational, it doesn't have anything until a child gives it a name or a function.
This, she says, is how you define a block. Blocks are modular. They relate to each other. They keep their shape, no matter the material.
And blocks basically rely on balance for building.
So much for mouse-driven digital Minecraft.
It didn't have that sensory feeling for me.
Hewitt is fascinated, though, by new games that combine real blocks and screen blocks, like the inevitable Lego Minecraft tie-in, or a math-based game called Building Blocks that uses actual blocks and virtual ones.
Exploring ideas of geometry and spatial relations and patterning and number.
But Hewitt believes the lesson of blocks is even more fundamental and powerful.
The ability to construct, it has to do with, you know, our whole culture. Where do we live? How do we make our homes? It's really the beginning of thinking about survival.
Kids have loved blocks for so long and so loyally. It's kind of amazing Hollywood's never tried to cash in with, you know, blocks. The movie could be a blockbuster. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This morning, we remember the actor who managed to turn a mafia boss into an everyman. James Gandolfini, who became famous as Tony Soprano, has died at 51 years old, suddenly in Rome, the possible cause, a heart attack. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates has this appreciation.
James Gandolfini had been a character actor for years before he was given a chance to read for Tony Soprano in a new series about a New Jersey mob boss HBO was producing in the late 90s. He loved the script, but he told Newsweek a few years later, back then he didn't think he'd get the job. I thought they would hire someone a little more debonair. But series creator David Chase told Fresh Air's Terry Gross he knew as soon as Gandolfini walked into the room, he'd found his man.
Without Jim Gandolfini, there is no Sopranos. There's no Tony Soprano.
Chase went on to say that the series' success depended on Gandolfini's ability to make viewers empathize with a man they'd find repulsive under normal circumstances.
That's why the whole thing, I think, is so identifiable to so many people, because he just is so human. And people respond to him. Their hearts and their heads go out to him, despite the heinous things he's doing on screen.
It was the soulful eyes, the rueful grin, and the bulky body. James Gandolfini's Tony Soprano could go from teddy bear to snarling pit bull in about 5 seconds, depending on whether he needed to charm or terrify. Co-star Edie Falco played his long-suffering wife, Carmela, and she told Morning Edition in 2002, viewers should be very clear, Jim Gandolfini was not Tony Soprano.
No, he's quiet and smart and introspective, lovely, everything you could hope for in a co-worker, actually. He's a dream come true.
Although his character's balancing act was enough to give any actor nightmares. On the one hand, Tony Soprano was a mob boss with all the pressures of keeping unruly colleagues and envious competitors in line, using all the splatter-worthy measures you can think up, and then some. On the other, he's the father of two spoiled teenagers and a wife who's furious with his regular infidelities and occasional attempts at discipline. In this scene, Carmela and Tony are fighting because Tony has decided he wants to send son AJ to military school. Carmela is having none of it.
He is still a child. He's a normal child. He's made some mistakes, and God knows he's got a shitload to learn about life. That does not mean that I'm going to let you send him to the type of school whose whole reason for being is to make him follow orders by instilling fear.
He thinks the world owes him a f***ing living.
What could have given him that bizarre idea?
That sounds like a whole lot of parents disagreeing about how much to discipline the kids, right? With different language, maybe. Gandolfini was famously modest, attributing the success of The Sopranos to a superb ensemble cast and brilliant writing. True, but it was also his ability to create a character whose complexity drew viewers in week after week, and that earned him a slew of prestigious awards, including 3 Emmys. Some of the most lauded and intense scenes were with Lorraine Bracco, who played psychiatrist Jennifer Melfi. Tony consulted the doctor about his depression and eventually fell in love with her.
Forget about the way that Tony Soprano makes his way in the world. That's just to feed his children. There's 2 Tony Sopranos. You've never seen the other one. That's the one I want to show to you.
Fortunately for the Sopranos fans, James Gandolfini did a great job of showing both. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Under the Dome is one of the most anticipated TV shows of the summer. It starts Monday on CBS. The show takes place in a tiny New England town that's suddenly mysteriously sealed off by an impenetrable dome. And as we hear from NPR's Netta Ulibi, Under the Dome comes from 2 very famous Stevens.
This is the first time we'll see an on-screen collaboration between Steven Spielberg and Stephen King.
Yeah, the Steven Squared, we call it.
That's Neil Baer, executive producer.
I was hugely intimidated.
That's Brian K. Vaughan. He wrote the first episode. In the show, like the novel, the dome crashes down out of nowhere. People think it's an earthquake or a natural disaster.
We have a problem here.
All our landlines are dead.
No phones, no internet, or television. If you try to get in or out, you smash into invisible barriers.
Stop the truck!
Parents are cut off from children. Tourists are literally trapped. The military swarms in, trying to rescue the town, but its citizens are stuck with each other.
Our daughter is sick. We need to get her to a real doctor. I mean, even if they can't knock that wall down, they can still airlift her out of here.
Well, I don't know, but if those eggheads out there can drop a car on Mars, they sure as hell can figure this out, too.
The little town becomes a societal petri dish, says producer Neil Baer.
How are they going to get along? How is the government going to work? Who's going to be in charge?
Such questions fascinate both Stevens, even though the two seem so different on the surface.
Stephen King is someone who's, you know, has the ability to see the worst in humanity.
Take Carrie or The Shining. Whereas Steven Spielberg's world, says Vaughn, just glows with idealism.
They're kind of polar opposites, but there's a little bit of overlap in the Venn diagram because I think they're both such aggressive humanists.
The show manages to raise topical issues. Climate change, the collapse of small American towns, how to deal with dwindling resources.
It was really written from a place of anger.
Executive producer Neil Baer says when Under the Dome was published in 2009, Stephen King had a lot on his mind.
I think King was angry about the direction the country was taking and how we were treating each other and how we were treating the planet, yet it never comes off as a screed.
Instead, it's almost a meditation on how quickly a society can dissolve. That's suggested in a scene between a cautious, reasonable town sheriff and a politician scheming to exploit the situation's instability.
What happens if this thing lasts for days or weeks? Well, we might need more manpower to maintain the peace. What are you getting at, Jim? Well, during emergencies, councilmen have the power to authorize additional police officers. The last thing this mess needs is amateurs with badges. You're not authorizing anything.
When it comes to worst-case scenarios, you could do worse than checking in with Annalee Newitz. She edits the science fiction website IO9, and she just published a book about surviving mass extinctions. She says the idea of a town sequestered under a dome is not exactly original.
There's actually a lot of stories that have this same idea. I mean, you could even claim it goes back to, you know, No Exit, where people are trapped in hell together.
There's no need for red-hot pokers. Hell is other people.
There's also a really depressing German movie about a woman trapped alone.
Ich bin ganz allein und ich muss versuchen, die langen, dunklen Wintermonate zu überstehen.
And the Simpsons movie that puts Springfield under a dome.
The town is running low on supplies of everything from gasoline to Botox.
And an old Twilight Zone episode, where a suburb lapses into mob rule after aliens seal it off.
Throw them into darkness for a few hours and then sit back and watch the pattern.
And this pattern is always the same?
With few variations. They pick the most dangerous enemy they can find. And it's themselves.
And so the dome becomes the magnifying glass that we use to look into these terrifying examples of human relationships.
Newitz liked Under the Dome, the book and the first episode of the new show. She was impressed by the adaptation and the special effects, like what happens to a poor cow standing in the wrong place when the dome slams down. It's perfectly bisected.
No cows were injured. This was not a real cow.
Executive producer Neil Baer points out the cow was writer Brian K. Vaughan's gory idea.
It's a woodchuck in the book, and that was one of my first tentative changes. But I asked Stephen King if it would be okay that I thought an adorable woodchuck getting split in half, we'd lose our audience.
Both Vaughn and Baer expect Under the Dome to exceed its planned season of 13 episodes. In fact, they frankly relish the idea of trapping the citizens of Chester's Mill under the dome for years.
Oh my God, what are we going to do when Chester's Mill runs out of coffee? That is really when the true horror begins.
Of all the horror Stephen King has unleashed, homicidal cars, killer clowns, towns filled with vampires, a world without coffee might be his most terrifying yet. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.